jingo, won't you share our love? We will build for you a hut. You're gonna be our favorite nut. We'll have a lot of little low, by golly. Then we'll put them in the follies. By jingo, said by gosh, by gee. By Jiminy, please don't bother me. So they all went away singing, oh, by gee, by gosh, by gum, by jub, by jee.
Hello, and welcome back to the American Writers 100 Pages at a Time podcast. So in this episode, I guess we'll finish looking at Black Boy, specific Black Boy, American Hunger, I should say. Like if you ever buy these and see just Black Boy, I think that's just the first 250 pages, just the part until he goes north. But if you get American Hunger, which was the original title he provided for this book when he wrote it, and I think it was like 1943, 44 he wrote it, it would only be published with the first part, because the second part, it's sort of thematically different. I think there are commonalities. I think there is some themes he's going at generally about, there is sort of a narrative between the two, but, you know, the second half deals a lot with the politics of communism, which maybe publishers didn't want to touch, and it does feel tonally a little bit different. And some of the things that Wright says about communism, you know, he puts it basically in a good light, although he's very disillusioned. It's a breakup story. At least part two, the what's it called, the fear and the glory, I think, or the horror and the glory. It's the same thing. It provides both horror and glory. The Communist Party, the movement, is a glory. It's mentioned several times in the text as a glory. He says that again and again. How amazing it is! How amazing. You know, the fact that you had whites who are anti-racist, that you had an institution looking to the future, that you had a vision of the future that he accepts pretty much through the end. I mean, the final scene of the book is him marching in a Communist Party march, hearing the Internationale being sung in English, even though he has turned his back on the party. He's rejected it. So it's a breakup story. But it's the love story is still there. Like, the love is still there, the glory is still there. But it's also, he sees the horror of it, and he sees the dangers of it, and that leads him to ultimately leave the party. Now, my understanding is that the timeline presented here and the timeline in real life is different. Like, he doesn't actually leave the party till 44 or 43. And the way he writes this, he makes it sound like he leaves the party probably in 39, like when he's involved with the Federal Writers Project. So that would be like 38, 39. That's a little bit of a personal, like, retconning. And obviously there's fictionalized parts in this book, so I think maybe it's okay because he doesn't throw out. But he leaves the party, according to this text, in response to trials of Communist Party members by the American Communist Party and people being exiled from the movement for intellectualism and bourgeois tendencies, essentially. And the same thing happens to Wright. Wright's also a bit, you know, criticized and kind of put on trial. And I think, does he ever get to trial? I don't know. But he's definitely being reprimanded by the party for the places he goes as a writer. Like, he's writing for the masses, or is the new masses by this point, the Communist Party magazine, and he's doing his own writing, the stories that will become Uncle Tom's Children, and he's, of course, working on Black Boy around this, not Black Boy, sorry, he's working on Native Son by this point. And something about these writings, they're not ideological, right? So he's running afoul with the movement. And other people get kicked out of the movement, basically for being intellectuals. So there's all these tensions between, like, the people involved in the Federal Writers Project, which was the WPA program for writers, and the Communist Party activists. And he mentions many famous people in the movement that he met in Chicago. So it's for these reasons he leaves, according to the text. Now, the biography at the end of this volume suggests he leaves because he's upset with the Stalinist show trials, not really the Nazis. I know many people left the Communist Party after the Nazi-Soviet Pact of 1939, which they saw as the betrayal. But he doesn't leave till well into World War II. when the show trials would have been more well known. So maybe he couldn't bring himself. I mean, the way he talks about the party here, it is an emotional tie to it. And he really believes in the mission. He believes in the vision. He believes in that future. And he actually says it several times here, like, I may not be a part of this. I'm stepping out, but this is a future. I mean, this is a path for America. It scares him. He says, if they were in power, they might shoot me and execute me. But he has a belief in the inevitability of this vision winning out. So he's still in love with it. That's the point. So that's why I think of it as like a tragic breakup story. This is, I'm all talking about part two of Black Boy. Now, obviously, part one of Black Boy is nothing like this. That's an intellectual maturation story, right? Becoming autonomous, becoming free of the South, learning the rules of Jim Crow, but at the same time learning his own vision of the world. And these two things coming together in making him a fully formed person who's able to venture out, right? And turn his back on Jim Crow and go to Chicago. That's a story, and it is a self-contained story, so I can see publishing it on its own. It works. Part two begins with him arriving in Chicago. Eventually, he brings the rest of his family. He works various jobs here and there, and eventually takes up writing, gets involved in Communist Party politics, despite at first being very skeptical of the communists he meets, who he would think he sometimes saw as being kind of silly. Like the first time he meets black communists, he talks about they're dressing like Trotsky or dressing like Lenin and doing the arm gesticulations and wearing this ridiculous clothes, acting in a ridiculous way and talking in this overblown ideological language to people, in a sense trying to replicate like the Bolsheviks. Now, in a sense, do you blame him? Many movements at the time on the left or anti-colonial did draw inspiration from the Bolsheviks because the Bolsheviks won. They were a model of something successful. Other movements, not so successful, certainly in America. So why not embrace it? It seemed if it worked in Russia, maybe it can work somewhere else. Why would you turn on tactics that worked? I think the victory of the Soviet Union, of course, did a lot for the international communist movement, but maybe it also limited it in some way. I'm not ready to make that claim. I'm just saying it's had the Russian Revolution not happened the way it did, maybe that would have freed up more national communist movements. I don't know. Like, now, I do think the Comintern was not entirely off track in how they dealt with American communists, like telling them to focus on racial solidarity, like make civil rights, make race an issue, and be anti-racist, be the one anti-racist group. That is something that made that movement attractive. It was a selling point of the party. And of course, we know from Robin Kelly's book, many communists were in the rural South. Richard Wright, obviously, attracted by that aspect of it. And it's one reason he's emotionally very tied to it throughout the book. It's because, these are the white people he saw who treated him as an equal and never in a contingent way. They were truly anti-racist. They were just a bit demented in how they saw art or how they saw him and how they saw the movement. I mean, it's a breakup story, right? It's you're with someone, you love someone, you care for them. There's a lot you do love about them. You could see yourself with someone like that. You imagine a future with this person. You imagine that mostly as good, but there's some aspects of that make that not possible, right? Something about their personality, something about the way they treat you, something about their choices that make all of that ultimately just a dream. So the horror makes the glory impossible, but it doesn't mean the glory's not still there, not still visible. And when you look at the thing, it's like, so on that day they break up, this man and a woman, the man looks at the woman, realizes he has to break up, realizes that there's no future here, but still, if for a moment can compartmentalize that aspect of it, can see something glorious there, right? And that's what Richard Wright is. So this is not And I've seen some comments, like in the YouTube audio book I was listening to, and in the and just around that, this is like anti-communist. I don't think so. I think it's criticizing an aspect of the American Communist Party, and maybe the certainly it's like anti-Stalinist. And it's really focused on this show trial kind of aspect of it. And all of it seems kind of silly, doesn't it? The Communist Party is a super, super small part of the American left in American society at this time. And, of course, Stalin has this ideologically driven show trials. Actually, it's more about political power, but, you know, that was part of the Stalinist system. So American communists trying to replicate their own movement, do the same thing before they even achieve victory. It's all kind of, it seems sort of silly. It's like you're kicking people out of a party that, and what does that do? They'll just go on. They'll still be leftists, I presume, most of these people. They joined the party for a reason. They could still be activists. They're just not Communist Party members. You're just hurting yourself, right, by not being ideologically open. But they're sort of learning the wrong lessons from Russia, that you need this ideological purity. Now, this comes out, of course, out of the lessons they were taught in democratic centralism. If you're familiar with democratic centralism, it's an idea in Leninist parties that you can have debate within a party on issues, but once a decision is made or a policy is reached, you must have party uniformity and conformity on that issue. You can't bring it up again. It's not meant to be debated once it's decided upon. Whether that's really democratic, it's certainly not liberal democracy, but in their view, that's, if the Communist Party is speaking for the masses and the party makes a decision, that is representative of the will of the masses. Now, there's a few leaps of logic you have to do to get there. But that's the idea of democratic centralism, and they're embracing it. I just think when you're dealing with a small movement that doesn't have much chance of success in the United States. Now, again, in the context of the 1930s, you could say, well, the Bolsheviks didn't look like they'd have a chance either, right? But that aside, why would you spend so much time and effort like on ideological purity, right? If Richard Wright, who believes in the vision and is a great writer and can speak to the racial question in ways that other people couldn't, was writing hundreds of articles for the masses. Actually, there's a volume of Library of America for us, is Richard Wright's Masses articles. I would love to get a look at all of these if they're available. I'm sure they are available somewhere. But it's, anyways, that's kind of the story here. And I think it's well done. Now, part two is only about 6 chapters, and like I said, most of it deals with his relationships with the Communist Party and the development of his writing career, and how these things end up being competing, because it's his writing career that gets him sort of labeled as an intellectual, a bit bourgeois, the typical thing, right? That somehow intellectuals are suspect. This is a bit of a contradiction, I think, in the communist movement overall, and when many intellectuals are attracted to this vision and the critiques of capitalism, and might find something in the party worthwhile, but that same thing that bring them to the party are their individualism, their ability to think for themselves, their ability to analyze problems and systems, all those things that intellectuals have and writers have. And then that turns around and says, well, you can't really be one of us because you think this way. You're not pure. You're not ideologically as pure as you should be. And obviously a movement that suppressed all diversity and all different opinions is going to be a pretty weak and ineffectual movement, as the Communist Party of America turned out to be. Let's not kid ourselves, right? This was a failed social movement, right? You got who did achieve something for the American people and for Black Americans, for that matter. Roosevelt passing executive orders that required non-discrimination in war contracts, which in World War II is everybody. Every business is essentially tied up in war contracting. You have the New Deal, and I know a lot's been written about how the New Deal has its own contradictions in terms of race, but poverty alleviation through the New Deal programs, jobs in war industries, all these things Eventually integrating the military. I guess that's Truman. And so kind of screw that guy. But he at least did that. So the New Deal, in a sense, I guess it's just to be frank here, the Comintern did say work with the New Deal, right, to American communists. And it worked out. You actually had gains for people that are actualizable. What did the Communist Party do? Not too much, as far as I can tell. It doesn't mean it's not an interesting movement, not worth studying, and even being a bit teary-eyed over from time to time. But there's got to be kind of a limit to how far we go with that, because it becomes a bit comical after a while if you keep that up. So, anyways, I'm kind of dwelling too much. Is there much more to say about this? You really do get this feeling of Richard Wright kind of moving into another world in Chicago constantly, and that's never really goes away. Like, so much of the South is in him and in his blood that he always feels kind of a bit of, you know, he's never stops being of the South. I guess that's the point I'm trying to make. Even late in the book, when he's been up here for, you know, 15 years or so, he's talking about, you know, how shocked he is, or how, like, it still takes him aback that these white communists are anti-racist. Or even when not talking about communists, he's talking about just people on the bus who don't stare at him and wonder, why is he on the bus, right? That's something that's clear in Black Boy, is that the white gaze on blacks in the South, the suspicion that's always there, it's like, why are you doing that? Why are you reading? Why are you on this bus? Where are you going? That constant suspicion is something he got used to, and as part of his training in the Jim Crow realities. In the North, though, he could go on a bus with a book with a white person, and the white person is indifferent to him, right? Now, maybe he's a racist deep down, I don't know, but he's not, like, sizing him up. Richard Wright, though, is sizing up the white guy and noticing this, because part of his defense in the South is to always keep an eye on the white people. This kind of suspicion and anxiety, the fear and hate that Bigger Thomas talks about. And these themes come up here too. It's something he's shocked by. But that doesn't mean Jim Crow hasn't reached into the North either, right? You know, like, there's moments where he goes to New York City for some Communist Party meeting, and he has to go to the Black YMCA. So there's segregated institutions even in the North. Well, anyways, I guess we can keep it short. I had a lot of fun reading part two of Black Boy. I like the name American Hunger more. I think I kind of like the original title. We keep Black Boy because that's the book people know. But Black Boy really is just the first part of this book. When you put them together, it is something different. It is a different beast. And some really beautiful writing here, like especially when he discusses the vision that the communists present, when he talks about the march at the end, where he kind of sees the future. Now, he says this is on May Day 1936, but he didn't actually leave the party till like 1943 or something. So he, in the book, in this reconstruction of himself, he leaves the party before the Nazi-Soviet Pact, which is super, super convenient. But some people try to say, you cannot allowed here, you're not in the party anymore, you can't be part of it. And eventually he joins the progression anyways, even being kind of beaten down at one point. And I don't know, it's just beautiful. I think just the sentiment of him being part of this vision that he hasn't stopped believing in. I mean, the last line from the International that we get from here is a better world's in birth, which I think he really still believes is possible there. And it can't be through America. It's going to have to be through something that challenges America's core. And for that, it communism maybe is the only path out. And when we see this in the context of Uncle Tom's Children and Native Son, I think there's a deep sadness about what the Communist Party really was in reality for him. Like, there's a lot he seems apparently could overlook. Like, he does in real life stay until the 40s. So he's obviously overlooking certain things about that thinking about this breakup, he's looking over, he's getting over a certain fault he sees in his mate because he still believes in that future with them. And, but eventually you can't, eventually you just can't bear it. So you have to suck it up, but it doesn't mean that person stops being beautiful to you. So anyway, that's kind of my thoughts about this second half. I really liked it. I actually like it better than the first half. I mean, there's so much impact into these 300 pages. I don't know. Dense book. Okay, so for the next 2 weeks or so, well, 5 episodes, 2 weeks, hopefully. I mean, that's if I'm lucky. I don't know. You get 2 episodes done a week, but next episode will be the next series of episodes will be The Outsider. And it'll probably be 5. There's actually 5 books. So as long as there's 5 kind of sub-books in the book, 5 sections, 5 chapters. So as long as those aren't too wildly, like, they look pretty close to being right. So I'll probably just do 1 episode, 1 book, and work our way through The Outsider, which... it's actually interesting. This is probably the first book by Richard Wright I heard of. And I don't remember where I heard about it. Like, as I said before, I've known about him a long time. I never read him until this series. But The Outsider was kind of in my mind, maybe because I did existentialism in college. I got exposed to the name because this is the most existential and influenced one. When he's kind of moved on from communism. And he kind of grafts onto that existentialism as a way of talking about race. But it seems this is like less well known. I can't find any audiobook versions on YouTube. All these other books have audiobook versions in them on YouTube. Little less commentary on The Outsider. So I'm a bit surprised by that. I thought this was a more famous book than... I thought there'd be more people talking about it and thinking about The Outsider, but it seems Native Son and Black Boy are the more popular Richard Wright books. And that's just something that struck me because I knew about this book, you know, for maybe since college or even before, but obviously never read it. Now I'm going to. So I'm really looking forward to beginning this jump into The Outsider. 5 episodes, as I said, is a fairly long book. But not bad, just a little bit longer than Native Son. But yeah, so that's where we're going. And then we'll do James Baldwin. And that will be a longer series because I think we have 3 volumes of James Baldwin's work. But that's going to be fun too. Very different type of writer, different generation, different themes, different tone, everything. So... that's it for now. Let me know what you think of American Hunger. We'll call it that, American Hunger / Black Boy as a whole, especially that last part on Richard Wright's participation in communism. So that'll be it for now. See you next time. Thanks for listening.
And every night they sang in the pale moonlight. Oh, by gee, by gosh, by gum, by jaw. Oh, by jingo, won't you share our you a hut, you're gonna be our favorite nut. We'll have a lot of little, oh by golly, then we'll put them in the follies.